Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the drug trust right after this. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools. They're banned from our public institutions and our national consciousness. Now, instead of these ten simple time-tested laws, we see the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And we're teaching these ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, in our public institutions, and we've made them a part of our national psyche. Now, you know, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but your daughter can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? Now, that's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still at least one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits that we all receive for their observance. Now, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what the penalty to the law is to suffer from its effect. So whether we call this the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, the Common Law, or Natural Law, or Karma, or something else, it's automatic, and it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happened to be the natural penalties for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. Doesn't cost you anything. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email, or click on to the web page that has our archives, the archives page. And you can download it or you can stream it right there. Now, if you're having a problem with georgegordon.org, go to georgegordon.com, georgegordon.com. And it'll do the same thing, and you can download it right there in the privacy of your own home without the inconvenience of that plain brown envelope. All right, we've been talking about the Drug Trust, and it's a book written by Eustace Mullins called Murder by Injection. We're in Chapter 9. Now, remember, I can only hit the highlights, just kind of little snippets of it. Now, we've got a series of programs, seven programs here, talking about this Drug Trust. The title of the book, Murder by Injection, does not do the book credit. It leads me to the conclusion that we're talking about inoculations. And there is one chapter in here, Chapter 4, that does, in fact, deal with inoculations. But the actual thrust of the book deals with the medical monopoly, a criminal syndicate that dwarfs the mafia and the Cosa Nostra. I mean, dwarfs them, makes them look like a bunch of pikers. This is an organized system that is international in scope, headed by the big banking industries, which have just looted the American Treasury and the American taxpayer for $29.1 trillion right in front of our eyeballs over the past year. I mean, these guys just, they just came in here and looted us, and most Americans love it. I mean, they're sitting there clapping and thank God for Barack Obama, and he's going to fix the economy. It reminds me of getting mugged on the streets of Mexico City, and the mugger hands you a 20 peso note and says, have a good day, and here's taxi fare back to your hotel. You'd say, what a wonderful mugger. He gave me taxi fare back to the hotel. Don't we love it? We've just been robbed by the banking industry, and they're telling us that now after we've robbed you, we're going to straighten out your economy. We're going to fix it for you. We're the guys that screwed it up, robbed you, and cheated you out of everything, and now just trust us. We're going to fix it for you. Well, the drug cartel has been doing the very same thing over the past 100 years. In fact, they've been in business. These drug cartels, these illegal drugs, they've been around for hundreds of years. Some of the biggest fortunes in the history of the world, like the John Jacob Astor, you know, that fortune was made, and the Harriman fortune and so on, were made with drugs. Oh, it's true that they went into hotels and railroads and did other things, but they got their stake money in drugs. And the CIA, I showed you last time here from the book on the drug trust, its major business thrust is drugs. It was organized for drugs. It was created for drugs. It is the world's predominant drug cartel, the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, for public consumption, they're also in the intelligence business. You know, just like the Harrimans were in the railroad business and the Astors were in the hotel business. You know, that's true. You got to have a cover. The mafia, they're in the garbage business. They're in all kinds of businesses, but their primary thrust in life is their criminal activities. Primarily, they're criminals. Now, the mafia doesn't have a good connection with the lawmaking powers and the lobbyists. And that's what makes the bankers shine. I mean, these guys are criminals of the first magnitude. These are the world's preeminent criminals because they control the lawmaking apparatus, which of and by itself is a criminal enterprise. You see, we have a commandment that says, you shall have no other gods before me. So the creator of the universe said, I don't want you people out here making these laws. Here in Missouri, our very first statute, first enacted in 1820, says that the law of England shall be the law of Missouri unless it's altered, reformed, amended, or changed. Which Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, and Deuteronomy 12, verse 32 prohibit. It says plainly, our Creator said, you shall not add to this law, and you shall not take away from it. We're not to add a dot or a crossed T to the law of God. Not to add to it or take away from it. Now, the only purpose for the Congress is to alter, reform, amend, or abolish the law of God. That's the only purpose for it. Doesn't have any other reason. So Congress enacts laws, and they create institutions and agencies, like the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates the pharmaceutical industry. So we have a criminal enterprise called the pharmaceutical industry, which is being supervised and regulated by the Congress of the United States, which is a criminal enterprise, which operates in violation of the First Commandment to the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. And then you and I all go out and register to vote so that we can participate in this two criminal activities, so we can get drugs. And now our president comes along and says, we want to give you these drugs free. Isn't that special? Free drugs. Yeah, we're going to get national health care insurance here in the United States, just like the rest of you people around the world, socialized medicine, so that we can get free drugs. Kind of like we get free public education. And here in the United States, our free public education, the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, which we all love, we all practice, has the most expensive educational system in the world. Costs $500 billion, $500 billion a year. It costs $10,000 a year to educate a child in the public school system. When he graduates, can't read his diploma. When you ask them, they can't tell you how many stars there are in the flag of the United States. When you ask them, they don't know where the Great Wall of China is and couldn't tell you where the Panama Canal is. But they've got degrees. They've got college diplomas. They've got high school diplomas. Tells us that they're all real smart people. And then these real smart people get jobs with government and government agents and agencies. And they work for the pharmaceutical industries and so on. And it shows. Now, the drug involvement in this operation should surprise no one, because the Rockefeller interests, having established the American Drug Trust, had long been active not only in ethical drugs, that is, the legal drugs, but in the unethical ones as well. And the Iran-Contra affair during the Reagan administration threatened to blow the lid off the Iran connection. It endangered the Israeli connection, the Swiss connection, the Rockefeller connection. But the danger was averted by astute maneuvering of the docile congressman and by adroit manipulation of the media to focus on Colonel Oliver North and Admiral Poindexter to the exclusion of their controllers. Thus, a crusade against communism, a noble effort to contain the communists, a la George Kennan, to be financed with the dirty money from the sale of drugs, was at last revealed to be the same old crew of the CIA agents peddling their drugs and laundering their money in various parts of the world. Now, the present writer is now researching a book which will document all of these operations. The CIA drug connection was not only deeply rooted in the quest for easy profits, but also in the concurrent plan to achieve total control over the people of the world by the masters of the drug trust. Thus, Bowart states, the cryptology, or the cryptocracy, is a brotherhood reminiscent of the ancient secret societies, with rites of initiation and indoctrination programs to develop in its loyal membership the special understanding of its mysteries. It has secret codes and oaths of silence which reinforce the sense of elitism necessary for the maintenance of its strict loyalty. The present writer has described some of these secret rites in The Curse of Canaan. Now, the emphasis on drugs and experimentation, which originated with the German allopathic school of medicine, and which has brought to this hemisphere, or was brought to this hemisphere, by Illuminati initiates, such as Daniel Coit Gilman, was the first step in transforming the entire medical practice of the United States from a patient-oriented healing process to a totally different approach, in which the patient became an instrument to be manipulated for the benefit of various other programs, mainly experimental science. Now, this had to be typified by Dr. J. Marion Sims, the mad doctor responsible for setting up what is now the Rockefeller-controlled Memorial Hospital Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. This total commitment to science also guided and inspired the CIA drug programs, Projects Bluebird, Artichoke, MK Ultra, and MK Delta, in which some 139 drugs were used on unsuspecting victims. The substances abused included cannabis, LSD, scopolamine, sodium amytal, chloral hydrate, the knockout drops of the Old West, ergo cocaine, morphine, and heroin. Now, the CIA drug story begins in 1943 when the organization was still known as the OSS. Dr. Albert Hoffman was experimenting in the Sandoz laboratories in Switzerland. Sandoz was then controlled by the Warburg family of Germany. Although Sandoz has been manufacturing a substance known as LSD since 1938, It had only been used in experiments with monkeys. A later form of this substance, LSD-25, produced amazing psychotropic effects, as Dr. Hoffman accidentally discovered when he absorbed a small quantity of rye fungus, the base for the drug, while he was working. This happened during August of 1943 at the height of the Second World War. Dr. Hoffman later reported that there surged upon me an uninterrupted stream of fantastic images of extraordinary plasticity and vividness and accompanied by an intense kaleidoscopic-like play of colors. I thought I was dying or going crazy. This was the first trip, the precursor of millions of such experiences by drug cultists. By 1958, Dr. Hoffman had expanded his interests to Mexican mushrooms and mescaline, both of which then became very popular among leading bankers in New York and among prominent Hollywood personalities. At the time of the discovery of LSD, Alan Dulles was posted in Switzerland as though by precognition. It was under his leadership that the CIA became transformed into the foremost operation of Dope Incorporated. He was then engaged in various activities with officials of the Nazi regime. To this day, no one has been able to ascertain whether he was trying to preserve the Hitler regime or to overthrow it. The most likely assumption is that he was trying to preserve it to a point lest the war end too soon for the profit-minded munitions makers, but at the same time to prevent any sort of victorious ending for the Nazi cohorts. The notes of Götterdämmerung had already been sounded. Dulles's association with the Hitler regime went back to a fateful meeting in Cologne, Germany in 1933, when he and his brother, John Foster Dulles, assured Hitler that the money would be forthcoming to guarantee the fruition of his goals as he set them forth in Mein Kampf. Alan Dulles later became a director of the Schroeder Bank, which handled Hitler's personal bank account. Interestingly enough, no one has ever been able to trace 1 cent of Hitler's considerable personal fortune, which he had received from the sale of his books and other income as the head of the Nazi Party. Now, unlike his opponent, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Hitler had no trust fund from his mother, the proceeds from the China opium trade. Dulles, as an international spy master, would probably have been aware of Dr. Hoffman's experiments. After he had returned to the United States and became director of the newly created CIA, Dulles ordered 10 kilograms of LSD from Sandoz Laboratories, and the stated purpose being for use in drug experiments with animals and human beings. As there are some 10,000 doses per gram, this meant that Dulles ordered 100 million doses of LSD. Meanwhile, a Dr. Timothy Leary had been hired by the National Institute of Health to experiment with psychedelic drugs, including LSD. Dr. Leary had already been forced to resign from West Point and was later fired from the faculty at Harvard. Perhaps the only person who could say this. Leary's NIH study was financed by a grant from the Urus Foundation of New York City. It continued from 1953 to 56 when it was moved to the U.S. Public Health Service. The experiments going on until 1958 and also at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare from 1956 to 1963. A CIA memo dated November 1, 1963, featured glowing accounts of the work of Dr. Leary and his associate, Dr. Richard Alpert, who also was later fired from the staff at Harvard. They invented the turn-on, tune-in, drop-out movement, which was incapacitated the youth of America for an entire generation. the movement in which the CIA always had a proprietary interest. It was given academic status when it was launched from the ivy-covered halls of Harvard by Leary and his group. After their forced departure from Harvard, they were ensconced in a million-dollar estate in New York by the wealthy Mellon heir, Tommy Hitchcock. Their movement swept over the campuses of American universities and destroyed the educational opportunities for thousands of American youth. A later governmental investigation of the CIA, which was chaired, natural enough, by Nelson Rockefeller, made this comment in its Rockefeller report to the president on CIA activities. It said, quote, "Beginning in the late 1940s, the CIA began to study the properties of certain behavioral influencing drugs. All of the records concerning the program were ordered destroyed in 1973, including a total of 152 separate files. CIA also contracted with the then Bureau of Narcotics to have mind-influencing drugs given to unwitting subjects in normal life settings." The above referred to several unfortunate incidents in which CIA employees, who had been given doses of LSD without their knowledge, committed suicide under its malign influence. The families of these victims learned many years later of the true circumstances of these suicides and successfully sued the government to obtain financial settlements. One of the various CIA projects, the most notorious, was called MK Ultra. These programs were supervised by another prototype of the Mad Doctor, a Dr. Sidney Gottlieb. Despite the havoc wrought by his activities, Dr. Gottlieb was never brought to trial. And indeed, the then director of the CIA, Richard Helms, made certain that all of the records of the MK Ultra operation were destroyed during his last days in office, giving Dr. Gottlieb immunity to prosecution. Now, Dr. Gottlieb, who has been described by observers as a pharmaceutical Dr. Strangelove, envisioned dosing entire populations with hallucinogenic drugs. Influenced by his CIA experiments, the U.S. Army contemplated a program of driving whole populations insane with these drugs. Some 1,500 military personnel were then given LSD in tests run by the Army and the Army Chemical Corps during the mid-1960s. Many of these military people suffered severe psychological damage, the most terrifying symptoms appearing years later. The Army then moved on to testing a more powerful chemical hallucinogen, which is called BZ. This drug was tested at Edgewood Arsenal between 1959 and 75. About 2,800 soldiers were exposed to BZ. Some of them have since lodged complaints that they suffered irreparable damage from the experiment. One of the peripheral results of the CIA drug program was the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the blame subsequently being laid at the door of various groups, the CIA, the Mafia, the Cuban Communists, and others. Now, the basis for these charges was that all of them were deeply involved. To cover up the trail, some 40 people later died by violence. Some of them were media writers, the most prominent being the late Dorothy Kilgallen, a widely known columnist. In 1965, she used her connections to get permission to interview Jack Ruby in his prison cell. She later told friends that she had been able to obtain evidence that would blow the JF Kennedy case sky high. Shortly afterward, she was found in her apartment dead of what later was diagnosed as an overdose of barbiturates and alcohol. The apartment was a shambles, and all of her notes of her conversations with Ruby had disappeared, and to this day no one has ever admitted seeing them. The medical monopoly then used Kilgallen's death as an excuse to issue pious warnings about the dangers of mixing barbiturates and alcohol, but they said nothing about the dangers of visiting Jack Ruby. Now, early in 1967, Ruby repeatedly complained that he was being poisoned. He was then diagnosed as having cancer, but he died of a stroke, as did one of his accomplices, David Faree. The apparition of Dr. Sidney Gottlieb as the CIA's mad scientist is eclipsed by the record of Dr. D. Edwin Cameron, who epitomized the Hollywood version of the insane doctor experimenting on helpless human subjects. Born in Scotland, Cameron moved to the United States, where he became a citizen, and although he carried on most of his medical work in Canada, he was a resident of Lake Placid, New York. The basis for the two-country operation may have been a desire to avoid lawsuits. In 1943, Dr. Cameron received a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to set up a new psychiatric institute, the Allen Memorial Institute, as a wing of the Royal Victorian Hospital, the teaching hospital of McGill University in Montreal. The Rockefeller connection later resulted in some $10 million of CIA money being channeled to Cameron through Gottlieb as part of the MK Ultra project. This money was transferred to Dr. Cameron beginning in 1953 because he had already demonstrated his commitment to mind-altering experiments. The CIA funds were therefore marked for mind control. Dr. Cameron had come to the favorable attention of the Rockefeller interests after he invented some of the most terrifying psychiatric techniques ever known. He invented a process called depatterning, as well as a later technique called psychic driving, either of which would have done credit to any communist brainwashing expert. Depatterning began with heavy drug dosages combined with electric shock. The then popular electroconvulsive therapy, also known as ECT, as it was usually known, and it was later discredited for years because of the damage it did to the patients, but incredibly, has now been revived and is in constant use in some circles. ECT has been described by its victims as the most terrifying ordeal which can be imagined. Basically, it was simply the electrocution process, which was shut off just before it became fatal. The patient was strapped into a chair and electrocuted two or three times a day. Initially, depatterning was limited to the heavy drug dosages over a period from 15 to 30 days. This part of the program was called sleep therapy. It was a sleep cocktail, which itself was worthy of the imagination of a Dr. Frankenstein, consisting of 100 milligrams of Thorazine, 100 milligrams of Nimbutol, 100 milligrams of Secanol, 150 milligrams of Vernonol, and 100 milligrams of Phenergan, any one of which would be enough to put any patient to sleep. Now, this sleep cocktail was administered to the patient three times a day. Later, in the sleep therapy treatment, the patient was awakened two or three times a day to receive the electric shock treatments. And Dr. Cameron ignored the recommended voltage for shock treatments, increasing them 20 to 40 times higher than any other doctor had ever dared. He watched approvingly as the helpless patients screamed constantly during the electroshock therapy. It was his fond belief that the screams also were an essential part of the treatment, although it is likely that it represented his personal gratification. Now, the next step in depatterning, which was also one of the weirder Cameron inventions, was sensory isolation, in which the patient was placed in a large box with his eyes padded and his ears plugged. After some 30 days of the Cameron depatterning treatment, the patient was reduced to a helpless zombie. Satisfied that he had purged the patient of all previous images and ideas, Dr. Cameron moved into the next phase, which he called psychic driving. This consisted of forcing the patient to listen to tape-recorded messages repeated over and over thousands of times. This treatment was administered through pillow speakers or headphones. Every intelligence agency in the world was green with envy when they heard of the new Cameron techniques. Luckily, the CIA had been the first on the scene and provided him with ample funds for his lunatic obsessions. Hey, boys and girls, this is the United States of America, where this was discovered and where this was perfected. This didn't come from the KGB. This didn't come from the Gestapo. This isn't the Chinese water board treatment. This is funded by, this is invented by, this is created by Americans. God only knows what they did down there in Guantanamo to those prisoners. We will find out in 30, 40, 50 years, just like God only knew what was going on back in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. It wasn't until today that we're able to look back on that period 50 years ago and say, oh my God, look what they were doing. Now, whatever they were doing back then, they're doing today in spades, probably 10 times more of it. Now, do you want to participate in that? Is that your goal in life? Well, hell, if it is, you're in the right company. This is the right place to be at the right time. Get with the program. Stick with it. Now, if this is repulsive to you, you might want to think about, gee, maybe I ought to opt out of this. And the reason I suggest opting out is because the creator of the universe, the creator, you know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, says, you know, vengeance is mine and retribution is at hand. And there's an ass kicking coming, and I'm the guy that's going to kick the ass. So I just thought I'd bring it to your attention. You know, if you've been on the wrong side for a long time, you might want to change sides. And there's a shortage of time. I don't know how much time there is. I'm not a prophet. God doesn't talk to me and tell me what's going on or what his plans are. But we have a guide. It's called the Scriptures. And in the Scriptures, there are whole books like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Revelation, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26. There's more than 30 prophecies in the Scripture that describe this thing called Jacob's trouble, the Great Tribulation. And these activities that we're reading about here are activities that are described in the Bible as being the most horrendous, the most demonic procedures, the most demonic behaviors ever devised by the wicked, evil mind of Satan and of mankind are about to be employed on the people of planet Earth. It will be so bad that you will call out to God to die, because death will be a release from this thing called the Great Tribulation. Remember, the book now is called Murder by Injection. It's the story of the medical conspiracy against America. These guys ain't working for you, boys and girls. If you think these guys are working for you, dream on. And it's written by Eustace Mullins. Eustace Mullins, E-U-S-T-A-C-E, Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S. Remember, bravenewbookstore.com is the place where you go on the web, bravenewbookstore.com. And the phone number is 512-480-2503. Now, once more, that's area code 512-480-2503. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, and download it off of our archives page. And if that doesn't work, go to georgegordon.com, georgegordon.com. And you can get it right off of our archives page. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Drug Trust, Chapter 9 of Eustace Mullen's book here on murder by injection. And again, I can emphasize to you that I can only hit the highlights and some of the high spots here in the book. But notice here that vaccinations and injections are just a small part of the overall exposé. This story about the CIA and the drug connection, you may have heard little snippets and pieces and bits of information about drug smuggling or the Iran-Contra affair and so on. And the cover stories, of course, that come out in the major media. But the in-depth, here's where it's all laid bare. Just here's where the rubber meets the road. This is crime on a scale that's unimagined by the human mind. This is crime that criminals like the Mafia and the Cosa Nostra are pikers by comparison. I mean, you know, the Mafia and the Cosa Nostra are just nice guys, just out trying to make a living on the hard streets of New York by comparison to these people here in the halls of Congress, in the legislatures of America. And hey, these guys all go to college. These guys have education. These guys are knowledgeable. They know what the hell's going on. Hey, and they're good at covering it up, and they get paid well for it. The criminals in the Congress are being paid well. Al Gore has been paid $100 million for his criminal participation in this global warming scam. Bill Clinton is being paid and rewarded right now. Don't worry about Bill and Al. They've been well taken care of. George Bush, he's going to be well taken care of. And it doesn't make any difference whether you're talking Republicans or Democrats. Hell, they're all in this right up to their eyeballs. And furthermore, it isn't something that just happened in the last 10 or 15 years. It's been going on for 150. It started with at least Abraham Lincoln. At least Abe was in on this program. Now, born in 1901, we're talking about this Cameron now. Born in 1901 near Glasgow, Cameron had studied at the University of London, where he may have picked up some of his strange ideas. And he's also likely, or it's also likely, that he became involved with some cult in London, which featured such monstrous ideas. After all, Mary Shelley had written Frankenstein in that very same time frame. Throughout his activities in Canada, the CIA Technical Service and the Staff Chemical Division enthusiastically funded his work. Honors poured in on him. As word spread about his innovative techniques, he became chairman of the Canadian Psychiatric Association. Boy, that ought to make us all feel good. You know, you've heard about the Gestapo and the KGB and their driving people out of their minds and so on. Hell, this was invented by the CIA. Now, he was the chairman of the American Psychiatric Association and founding chairman of the World Psychiatric Association. After Dr. Cameron's death in 1967, the CIA found itself besieged by some of the survivors of his victims in the most advanced stages of MK Ultra. He had experimented on some 53 people. This group included some prominent Canadians. An action was finally brought by Harry Weinstein, whose father, Louis, had been a leading Montreal businessman. And another victim was Velma Orlikan, wife of a Democratic Party member of the Canadian Parliament. Despite these pedigrees, the victims found themselves up against a stone wall. The Washington Post noted in January of 1988 that the CIA was still fighting the action of nine elderly Canadians who had been drugged during the 1950s and were asking $175,000 each in damages, later increased to $1 million each. The case was then ordered to trial after 9 years of delaying tactics by the CIA. But no one is predicting a speedy solution. During the Cameron era, the CIA continued its own experiments in the United States. They enlisted the services of a narcotics operator, George Hunter White, and set him up in an apartment in Greenwich Village. He was given a cover identity as an artist and a seaman, who met people at parties or in bars and lured them back to the apartment. The CIA money had transformed the seedy apartment into an espionage apparatus, complete with two-way mirrors, surveillance, and recording equipment and other tools of the trade. White dosed his visitors with LSD, while the CIA equipment meticulously recorded their reactions. These frequently consisted of bad trips in which the victims went temporarily insane, tried to commit suicide or murder, and gave other evidences of the mind control which the CIA was experimenting with. To avoid exposure from complaints, the CIA transferred White to San Francisco, where he was given the run of two more CIA pads. He then initiated Operation Midnight Climax. Drug-addicted prostitutes were paid to pick men up in local bars and bring them back for an orgy, which featured drinks heavily laced with LSD. The ensuing action was taped and photographed in every detail, although the results were not likely to be made available to the Library of Congress. Despite the excesses to which doctors such as Dr. Cameron and Dr. Sims went to in their scientific enthusiasm, there are horror stories equally disturbing from the clinical experiments conducted by the ethical drug companies. With hundreds of millions in dollars of potential profits riding on each new drug product, the medical monopoly must comply with the regulations which they themselves have drafted and put into place. The purpose of these regulations is to protect the market share of a new wonder drug until it can be replaced by a newer wonder drug. As one alternative health care practitioner who had been sent to prison for selling herbal teas remarked, a wonder drug is a drug that you take and then you wonder what it's going to do to you. The restrictions on these new drugs are usually complied with if the manufacturer believes that it may be a big money maker. He is not about to release a new drug to the marketplace, have it meet with success, and then be forced to recall it because he has not complied with all of the regulations. These regulations keep the small entrepreneurs out of the marketplace because of the millions of dollars of costs that are built into the system that it takes to test these drugs. Now, from 1948 to 1958, the pharmaceutical companies introduced 4,829 new products, 3,686 new compounds, and 1,143 new dosages. All of these products had to go through the process. New drugs are reported to take an average time of from 7 to 10 years to receive the final FDA approval, a process which costs from $10 to $12 million, chump change to the pharmaceutical industry, and impossible barrier to entrepreneurs, and frequently as much as $18 to $20 million. Clinical testing goes through three clearly defined phases. Phase one calls for the testing of the new drug on a small number of healthy people. Phase two requires that volunteers take the drug during a two-year trial basis. And phase three calls for more diverse clinical testing on from 1,000 to 3,000 patients over a three-year period. This means that doctors and hospitals administer the drug only because the phase two testing has established its toxicity and other possible side effects. These are generally patients who are in a position to sue or generate unfavorable publicity if the drug proves to be dangerous, which means that those who prescribe the drug are relying on phase two testing to recommend it as reliable. Phase 2, in which the drug is tested on human beings, generally requires a captive population. The drugs are sometimes tested secretly in schools, hospitals, and mental institutions, but the pharmaceutical manufacturers usually prefer to rely on a much safer test population, those who are confined to our prisons, because they're unlikely to complain. Even inmates of mental institutions have been known to complain after their release that they were subjected to illegal drug testing. Prisoners who have been convicted of crimes are less likely to complain. Since the turn of the century, the United States has led the world in the number of medical experiments carried on in our prisons. The law-abiding citizen might think that it's all right to conduct medical experiments on prisoners, even though a number of German doctors were executed for just such an offense. Drug testing might be one way in which one prisoner could repay his debt to society. However, the reality of the situation today is that although there are many criminals confined in our prisons, there are also increasing numbers of Americans sent to prison for political offenses. These political prisoners run the same risks in medical experiments as do most hardened criminals. Each year, a large number of sentences are handed down by American courts as punishment for banking problems, mortgage problems, or tax problems. Because of the medical monopoly's control of the media, the use of prisoners in medical experiments rarely comes to the attention of the American people. It's never reported. An exhaustive search of magazine indexes from 1900 to the present day reveals only a few such stories which were uniformly favorable to the experiments. The prisoners themselves have little media access, and unless they riot and bring the cameraman in force with the full stop story, The American Medical Association is still the leading advocate of using prisoners for drug testing. The columnist Pertnex, writing in the British Medical Journal in January 1963, commented, "I'm disturbed that the World Medical Association is now hedging on its clause about using criminals as experimental material. The AMA influence has been at work on its suspension. At the 10th meeting, American scientists joked about it. One of the nicest American scientists I know was heard to say, 'Criminals in our prisons are fine experimental material and much cheaper than chimpanzees.'" The scientist was not making a bad joke. Chimpanzees cost as much as $4,500 each, while American prisoners can be had for as little as a dollar a day. Pertnex was commenting on the proposal made by the World Medical Association in 1961 and offered for adoption that prisoners being captive groups should not be used as the subjects of experiments. The proposal was vociferously objected to by delegates from the American Medical Association, and it was finally tabled. If this smacks somewhat of the crimes of the Nazi doctors and their experiments on prisoners, the coincidence is not accidental. The accused physicians testified in their own defense that they were merely following practices of long standing in the United States. And at one trial in 1947, 515 German doctors were tried at Nuremberg, indicted on the charge that they had conducted experiments on prisoners. They entered evidence in their defense that in 1906, American doctors in Philadelphia had used convicts for medical experiments, injecting them with plague and beriberi germs. In 1915, pellagra was injected into convicts in Massachusetts. In 1944, hundreds of prisoners in the United States were injected with malaria under the excuse of wartime necessity to aid our soldiers in the Pacific. Now, despite this defense, the German doctors were all convicted and some of them were executed. The subject surfaced again with the recent publication of Robert J. Lefton's book, Nazi Doctors, one of the series of books about Nazis which pour from American presses in an ever-increasing stream, obeying the dictum that anything sells in the United States if a swastika is emblazoned on the cover. The book resulted in a spirited discussion in the letters page of the New York Times Sunday Book Review. Bruno Bettelheim had originally reviewed the book, asserting that the effort to understand the Nazi doctors was wrong because of an ever-present danger that understanding fully may come close to forgiving. Christians, of course, offer forgiveness as a basic religious precept. Paul Ramsey wrote, to include an excerpt from an advertisement, Professor McCants and the members of the medical research department want to be informed if and when children are born in lying in homes and women's wards in hospitals afflicted with meningitis or similar abnormalities, which will make it unlikely that the children will survive longer than a short time. Now, Professor McCants and his department wish to make some experiments on these children, which will give them no sorts of pain, but they will feel entitled to make these experiments on normal, healthy children. And when the birth of these children comes to be known, Professor McCants is to be informed at once by telephone. Now, Mr. Ramsey noted that this advertisement appeared in an American publication in 1946 while the German doctors were on trial. Telford Taylor, the American prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, wrote in the Times to correct errors which had already appeared, including the statement that one of those sentenced was Edwin Katzenwallenbogen, who at one time had been a member of the faculty at the Harvard Medical School. Taylor stated that no one by the name of Kazenlenbogen had ever been on trial at Nuremberg. And indeed, the name seems to have been included as an elaborate practical joke, the name having surfaced in previous practical jokes. The Times made no apology. Telford Taylor further pointed out that 20 physicians had been tried at Nuremberg in the instance mentioned, not 19 as stated in the review, and that 4 were hanged, 5 sentenced to life in prison, 3 received lesser sentences, and 7 were acquitted on all charges. Now, large-scale medical experimentation, similar to that which was condemned as a crime at Nuremberg at the same time that it was still being practiced in American prisons, takes undue advantage of the volunteers. Some of these people are illiterate. Most are young and healthy and have never had any serious illness. They have little concept of what it may be like to come down with a serious illness as a result of being injected with experimental drugs or the lifelong complications which may result from these diseases. In 1963, Time magazine ran an exposé of large-scale programs which federal government officials had established in our prisons. These vast testing programs were justified as being part of the war on cancer, which Bobston Laskers had launched from the White House. The doctors were injecting prisoners with live cancer cells and with blood from persons suffering from leukemia. Several doctors in Oklahoma were grossing $300,000 a year from drug manufacturers in these deals. And these doctors also regularly collected blood from prisoners, paying them $7 a quart. They then sold the blood for $15. Let me put my arrow in the margin here and point out that this is going on in the United States of America today. Today, as I speak. This isn't something that just happened in the past, although it has happened in the past. And when Eustace Mullins did a search from 1900 through 1988 to find out how pervasive this is, he found only a few reports, and the few reports were all positive. That's a controlled media. Now, the prisoners, I haven't personally contacted them. I don't know how they are selected, whether it's put in their food or whether they're selected and given time off for good behavior or for medical experiments. I can't tell you. Not enough information is out there. But Mullins took a lot of time, effort, and energy to research as much as he could and to put it into this Chapter 9 called The Drug Trust. Now, again, I'm only able to hit the top surfaces, so the name of the book now is called Murder by Injection, The Story of the Medical Conspiracy Against America by Eustace Mullins. Go to bravenewbookstore.com. They're in Austin, Texas, and their phone number 512-480-2503. Now, once more, that's 512-480-2503. It's called bravenewbookstore.com. You're looking for Murder by Injection, Eustace Mullins. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.